This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
We know who our friends are, and we have the right to choose our own friends. Nobody should choose friends for us. We are here in Russia today to demonstrate that.
A Russia-Africa summit took place last week in St. Petersburg.
A woman called me up, working for Pfizer, exposed, sick. She said she couldn't talk about it. She was frightened. They make them sign gag orders. They can't talk about it. And it's not released to the public.
A former Pfizer molecular biologist speaks about the dangers of biotech lab work.
We're living in San Francisco. We need higher wages. We need our bonuses. Kaiser's made money, made $4 billion in the past 5 years. And you mean to tell me you don't have money?
More than 80,000 workers at Kaiser in California are fighting for better wages and more staffing.
The idea that Hunter Biden has been going around the world invoking his father's name in all these very explicit and aggressive ways, and his father never got wind of it, had no idea that it happened, is laughable.
Glenn Greenwald on Hunter Biden's legal struggles and their implications for his father, President Joe Biden. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. A Russia-Africa summit took place last week in St. Petersburg. Pacifica's Polina Vasilyev reports.
The second Russia-Africa Economic and Humanitarian Summit took place in St. Petersburg on July 27th and 28th. It was attended by 49 African delegations, including 17 heads of state. Zambian Socialist Party President Fred Mbembe told RT that attending the summit is, above all, an act of independence for Africans, because the U.S. had pressured them not to take part.
Many people have been discouraged to come to Russia. Many have been discouraged. Coming here is a demonstration of our independence. We take our own decisions. We know who our friends are. And we have the right to choose our own friends. Nobody should choose friends for us. We are here in Russia today to demonstrate that. Changes are taking place in the world today. The world cannot continue to be dominated by one country, one group of people, one group of nations. We all have the right to determine our own destinies. Each nation has the right to its sovereignty and to its security.
The Zambian Socialist Party leader further stated that Russia and African states share common security interests.
Today on the African continent, we have 29 United States military outposts in 15 countries. Definitely, it's not to protect the African interests, it's to project their own power, to protect their own interests, or to advance their own interests. France has got a presence in 10 countries, military. Africa's security has been threatened by the United States and the Western countries for many years, from the 60s, 70s, 80s. Presidents and the countries that tried to stamp their own sovereignty, defend their own independence, have been toppled, they have been killed. But what we are seeing today is an enhancement of that with what is called hybrid wars. The Russian Federation understands that much better because it's an example of a hybrid war. The war that is being fought with Russia and NATO in Ukraine, it did not start with a special operation. It started long before as a hybrid war. We are seeing another hybrid war in Venezuela. We are seeing another hybrid war against Cuba. We have seen a hybrid war against Zimbabwe. It starts with economic sanctions, orchestrated media coverage that is so negative, and the psychological warfare to turn the population against their own government.
The president of Eritrea, Isaias Afwerki, called out the U.S. for attempting to exercise hegemonic control for the last three decades.
For me, it's a continuation of one ideology. It's an ideology of slavery. It's an ideology of colonialism. It's an ideology of neocolonialism. It's an ideology, at least in the last 30 years, we can talk about hegemony, controlling. And Russia became a target. their ideology of not only containing Russia, but containing everyone who doesn't bow to this ideology has been there for the last 30 years. You will be punished if you are not in line with their way of thinking. It's either sanctions, it's either demonizing this or that guy, and using all sorts of tools, including the World Bank, IMF, and other tools they use to pressure everybody to bow to this ideology. And people are fed up of this behavior, this culture of domination, hegemony. Everybody is fed up of it. The people in Africa, above any other continent, would like to see this process going forward and changing their quality of life, not for this generation, but for the coming generation. So they would use every tool, like they are using now in Ukraine, to give the impression that this is a fight between Russia and Ukraine. This has nothing to do with Ukraine and Russia. This is their declared war that has been there for the last 30 years, and it's not only Russia. It's for everybody else, everywhere in Asia, in Latin America, Europe, the Americas. People are fed up of this thing. And when they try to pressure someone who doesn't bow to this ideology, it only emphasizes the fact that they are fed up. They have failed. Their mission has failed.
Dileka Mandela, Nelson Mandela's granddaughter, spoke about the vital role of a collaboration between Africa and Russia.
We, especially the frontline states, Russia's role in the liberation of the frontline state can never be forgotten. So it starts from there. And also, if you look at the BRICS collaboration, it is important for us to look at the Russian part, because, you know, the other blocs have been concentrated, well, up in India and China, if I have to mention those two. There has been a lot of buzzword within that bloc in the BRICS collaboration. But it is also important for the African continent to form, you know, economic relations with Russia. And because it's only through collaboration that we can grow as countries and as a continent. So I believe very much so that this has come at the right time for this summit to happen.
During a meeting with Vladimir Putin, the South African president, Cyril Ramaphosa, gave high praise to the organization and to the results of the Russia-Africa summit, highlighting that relations between their nations are based on mutual respect.
What is particularly pleasing is that Russia conducts its relationship with Africa at a strategic level, and it conducts it with a great deal of respect and recognition of the sovereignty of African states. And Russia has continued to be supportive of Africa, as it did in the past, even during the days of the Soviet Union. So we're very pleased that that spirit of cooperation continues, and we appreciate very much your own disposition towards it.
At the summit, Russian President Vladimir Putin announced that even though Russia has withdrawn from the Black Sea grain deal with Ukraine, it is still ready to supply African countries with grain for free in the next few months.
Russia agreed to participate in the deal, taking into account the obligations contained in it that illegitimate obstacles to the supply of our grain and fertilizers to world markets would be removed. I want to tell you that, above all, this is about helping the poorest countries. In fact, nothing happened from what we discussed and what we were promised. No terms of the deal regarding the withdrawal of sanctions on Russian exports of grain and fertilizers to world markets were fulfilled. None. Obstacles were also raised for our donation of fertilizers to the poorest countries in need. Of the 262,000 tons of such fertilizers blocked in European ports, only two batches were sent, 20,000 tons in total to Malawi and 34,000 tons to Kenya. The rest remained in the hands of the Europeans. This is despite the fact that it was a purely humanitarian in action, which, in principle, should not be subject to any sanctions. Our country is able to replace Ukrainian grain both commercially and in the form of free assistance to the most needy African countries. Moreover, this year we again expect a record harvest. In the next 3-4 months, we will be ready to provide free of charge to Burkina Faso, Zimbabwe, Mali, Somalia, Central African Republic, Eritrea, from 25 to 50,000 tons of grain to each. We will also provide free delivery of these products.
According to the United Nations, only 3% of the total grain volume went to countries that truly needed it as part of the now-defunct grain deal. Much of the grain went to well-off countries, including those in the European Union. On the second day of the Russia-Africa summit, Brazilian geopolitical analyst Pepe Escobar discussed the significance of the event with journalist Danny Haifong.
This is one of those real game-changing moments in the geopolitical chessboard. I was in Moscow during the preparation of this summit. That was in April, where foreign ministers were there and huge delegations from all over Africa. They were preparing basically this summit this week. And what happened this week is the scope and the breadth of the discussions is absolutely outstanding. They had panels on literally anything you can imagine, including two very important ones on decolonization. And obviously, the major leaders, heads of state, foreign ministers that are in St. Petersburg, of course. For them, this was a mix of being welcomed by Russia and by BRICS, considering that Russia is arguably with China the top two. In fact, they are the top two BRICS members who, let's say, conduct the major negotiations intra-BRICS, and bringing, of course, Africa to as some of the next BRICS members of BRICS Plus, which is going to be announced next month at the summit in South Africa and beyond, of course. But Putin went one step ahead. Today, he asked for Africa to be a permanent member of the UN Security Council in front of all of them. Obviously, this is something they have been discussing for years, in fact. And he said that Russia is a 1,000,000% behind introducing Africa as a permanent G20 member starting from September at the summit in New Delhi. So this is basically Russia telling the whole of Africa, okay, there are 49 delegations in St. Petersburg out of 54 nations. The ones that are not there is because the American French pressure was absolutely unbearable. And the American and French and EU pressure on all of, and UK pressure on all of them who are actually there in St. Petersburg, many of them spell it out on the record and off the record. And still they went, and still they knew that considering the preparations 3 months ago in Moscow, they knew that this would be big. And of course, the Russian diplomacy, which is peerless, had already talked to virtually all of the participants saying, look, we're going to make big announcements, including, of course, Russia totally erasing $23 billion of debt across Africa. This means now zero. Can you imagine the empire doing something like that? Never. Basically, there is a Russian offensive to get free trade deals between a lot of African Union members and the Eurasia Economic Union, just like the free trade deals that they have with Vietnam or Cuba, for instance. They want to expand these Eurasia Economic Union free trade deals with a lot of Africans, like dozens of African nations. And sooner or later, and this is the big thing, a very, very close cooperation between the leadership of the Eurasia Economic Union and the African Union. So we can see, I would say, medium to long term, a merger of interests and trade deals and close collaboration, not only in trade and agriculture, but in infotech and technology as well, between the Eurasian Economic Union, which, of course, Russia is the most important partner, but there's also Kazakhstan, which has many things that interest African nations. And I would say the top, at least the top 10 African nations will be very much interested in doing more business, more trade, and more technological interaction with the Eurasian Economic Union. Egypt, Senegal, Nigeria, Morocco, South Africa, which is part of BRICS. Many of these Africans will also become members of BRICS Plus in the short, medium, and long term. So maybe, let's say, you know, projecting 3, 4, 5 years from now, we can have maybe 4 or 5 of the top African economies as part of BRICS Plus. And of course, they are all African Union. And of course, doing more business with the Eurasian Economic Union, which means opening up to more business with China. Belt and Road Initiative.
Here's Alexander McCourris, editor-in-chief of The Duran, with more analysis of the Russia-Africa summit.
What is happening and what the Russians are saying is during the time of the Soviet Union, during the Cold War, we made a very big push to establish very good and good, close relationships with people in Africa. We were at the forefront of support of the anti-imperialist and anti-colonial movements in Africa. We supported the movements against apartheid in South Africa, in Rhodesia. We helped Angola see off Western intervention, South African intervention in the 1970s and 1980s. We played an absolutely key role in helping Ethiopia to hold together in the 1970s and 1980s as well, after the fall of the emperor. We were very heavily involved in West Africa too. Then the Soviet Union collapsed. All of that stopped. We stopped taking any interest in Africa anymore. We neglected our old friendships. We now understand that that was a critical mistake. We didn't have the means to some extent to project ourselves back into Africa. Now we want to do so. And we want to come back into Africa in a big way. We also support African Union. We want the African Union, which is the organization that brings together all the African states, to be admitted as a full member of the G20. We are going to write off all your debt to us. I believe that's $20 billion. We're going to write all of that off. We're going to once again re-establish all the old links, all the old educational links that the Soviet Union used to provide. The Soviet Union had very, very extensive education graduate programs for Africans during the Cold War. We've renamed the university that was set up in the 60s to provide African students from other global South countries. We've given it back its old name, which it had in the 60s and 70s, which is the Patrice Lumumba Friendship University, renamed after an African leader. And we are going to give you also, if you're really in need of food, we have the means. We can replace all the food that Ukraine provided. We have more than enough to do that. And we're going to provide it for free. And we want to increase our economic links with Africa. They're too low at the moment, but we want to increase those very considerably. So that's what the Russians are saying. And of course, what the West is saying in response is, under no circumstances, this is not something that African leaders should even consider, getting too close to the Russians. If you get too close to the Russians in that way, you are going to be cut off from any potential World Bank or IMF funding. Now, this is playing out, as I said, in a major geostrategic struggle in Africa. Bear in mind, behind the Russians are the Chinese with their very deep pockets, who are also coming to Africa in a very, very big way. And of course, the Chinese and the Russians are working together on this.
That was Alexander Mercouris, editor-in-chief of The Duran. For Capitalism, Race and Democracy, I'm Paulina Vasilyev.
That was Bob Marley, Africa Unite. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. Biotech laboratory leaks are a danger throughout the world. Yet even in the U.S., there is no real oversight and protection of biotech workers and the public. Becky McLean is a molecular biologist who worked at a Pfizer lab in Groton, Connecticut, with 6,000 other scientists. She found a biotech leak and tried to protect workers and the broader public by reporting it to OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Hazard Administration. Pfizer harassed, bullied, and fired her, but she sued Pfizer and won. She spoke with Pacifica's Steve Seltzer.
Well, the lessons of my struggle is that I basically biotech workers have no health and safety rights to even institute a laboratory safety committee within their own department. If they raise safety issues, the company is not legally bound to address them. And if you go to OSHA, OSHA has been captured, you get no response. You get your case thrown out. I truly believe there's no solution unless workers unionize and fight for their rights. It's going to be a big struggle, but there's no protections for exposures. If you get exposed and you become ill, you have no rights to find out what you were exposed to so you can get medical care. I found that trade secrets supersedes my right to get that information, even though they egregiously exposed me and made me ill. It's so encompassing, the lack of workers' rights, that we're going to have to union. Biotech workers will have to unionize to be able to get their rights.
And you went to OSHA. What was your experience with OSHA? Because OSHA is supposed to be an agency organized by the federal government, supported financially by the federal government to protect workers in all industries. And they apparently did not even investigate your laboratory.
No, and I had credible, documented, egregious safety issues from several scientists, not just myself. Basically, they ignored it. And after several written requests and verbal requests, they never went in to inspect. And that's even after reporting injuries that were documented. So I don't think workers can really trust OSHA at this time. The agency appears to be captured. That's it.
Well, one of the things you did learn, and you talked to David Michaels, and he admitted to you that they're not even inspectors who are knowledgeable about the dangers of biotech releases at biotech laboratories. I mean, how could that be in the United States that the agency, which is responsible for health and safety, doesn't have any capacity really to even send inspectors in to find out what is going on if there's a biological release? I mean, one of the issues going on in China, this potential biotech release there, China has admitted they also had biotech releases at the Wuhan laboratory prior to the COVID. But I mean, if you can't even get investigators who have the training, who have the professionalism to investigate what's going on, it seems like that's a serious health and safety danger to the American people and to biotech workers.
Yes, my investigator, I believe she was a military police officer or something of that sort. She had no biological background. Trying to explain to her the functions of the genetically engineered viruses that were being made and the gains of functions that they were manipulating these viruses with was very difficult because she was a layperson. But in general, you know, it's not that difficult. It shouldn't be that difficult for OSHA to understand. Here's a genetically engineered virus that can infect a person, and they should be able to bring someone in there and look at the situation. Now, if she would have gone in and inspected like she said she was going to do, You're right. She did would not have the background to understand what was going on. And even when I went to the state agency, the person, the investigator of the state agency had a biology background, but he didn't have molecular biology background. So it's very difficult for someone without expertise to go in and really inspect the labs. OSHA could make a deal with NIH if there was a problem. They could call NIH and say, give me a person that has some expertise that they could collaborate with someone, but they don't. I don't know if they do it on purpose, that the investigators don't understand the science behind what they're investigating, or if they just don't have the resources for an OSHA hire. But again, intercross connections between agencies, they could probably, my assumption is they could get someone from NIH with that expertise, but they don't do that.
And Becky, you had a health problem. You were infected at the Pfizer lab. So even healthcare is an issue. I know that workers are getting infected in biotech labs, but you can't find that out. A lot of that is secret information. As long as you have private control of the healthcare system and workers' comp, it's all undercover. It's all private. And the correlation between disease and environment is very much hidden. You brought it up in the community. I know one of the reasons you may have won your lawsuit was people found out that the biological material was being released into the air, into the community.
That did happen. But I believe why we're not getting a lot of information about exposed biotech workers, because they have to sign gag orders. A woman called me up, working from Pfizer, exposed, sick. She said she couldn't talk about it. She was frightened. They make them sign gag orders. They can't talk about it. And it's not released to the public. Allison Young just published what he was working on, about releases from biolabs. Allison Young just published a book called Pandora's Gamble. And it shows that we have a major biosafety issue in the United States. And this has been happening for a while. And I'm glad she put it all together into a book. I don't know how popular the book is, but I think it's significant to note that. But the rights of workers and their constant lack of freedom of speech because of forced gag orders on them when they're sick and they're scared is... That's why I don't know. I think a union might be able to stop that. The other thing about unionization, I don't know. I've never been in a union. It's just, I'm just like, I don't know what else to think. At least they could get a safety committee, right? I mean, we were not allowed to have a safety committee. Our safety committee was silenced when they started bringing up safety issues, and then they wouldn't address them. And then it was, we couldn't form an adequate safety committee to get our safety issues addressed. So maybe a union could at least do that.
Well, one of the issues that has to be addressed, though, is why are there less than 2,000 inspectors for 130 million workers in the United States, number one? And number two, why is there no inspectors for biotech? And David Michaels admitted that they didn't have professionals to inspect in biotech. With these new industries, nanotech, you would think that it should be required that for new technologies that there be inspectors who are trained and understand the dangers of these new technologies. Yet, it's not a priority. It's not in the budget. And even though David Michaels is aware of that, he did not make that a national issue. Maybe he was afraid of his job. Because that might have gotten him fired. But the fact of the matter is, you have to make noise to get action, and you have to publicize what the issues are so people understand the dangers and the necessary requirements.
But free speech is really under attack right now. I thought it was before COVID. And if you agree or not, your position about the vaccine, the censorship to me is indicative that we are in big trouble. I thought it was only on workers. Now they're coming after the public for censoring the public.
That was Becky McLean, a former Pfizer molecular biologist. That was the Chambers Brothers' Time Has Come Today. More than 80,000 workers at Kaiser in California are fighting for a contract that will not only raise their wages, but also increase staffing. Pacifica's Steve Seltzer spoke to workers at a rally outside San Francisco's Kaiser Hospital.
July 22nd, and it's unsafe, staffing going on, we didn't get our bonuses, they're saying we make too much money. I worked through this whole pandemic, putting our lives at stake to make sure other people were okay, but Kaiser doesn't care, they don't care about us, it's just greed and money, and we're here honestly from my genuine heart for patient care. I'm a carpenter in the day, look at my boots, yeah, and I not come to Kaiser in the evening because I love what I do.
It's affecting patients.
It's affecting the patients. There's a risk, a safety risk factor, because there's room. There could be an error. There could be a safety issue with being unstaffed. I work in urgent care, and we are understaffed. I'm one medical assistant sometimes with four doctors, because you have three medical assistants to four doctors. You got one person going to the front to cover the front reception. Then you got one person doing a procedure. That leaves me with four doctors. That's not safe staffing. So we need to get it together, Kaiser, and let's get it together soon before something happens, like a fatality, God forbid.
And do the executives know about the short staffing? Are they aware of how bad it is?
Honestly, I don't know. I really can't state. They may know or they may not know, or maybe they're told from the uppers to keep the money in their pockets so the managers get bonuses. I have no idea.
I mean, they might get bonuses by saving money on the staffing?
They may. It could happen. It could happen. I want to say it could happen. I see that happening in the field sometimes where certain people will try to save money here or there for their bonuses later. And I've heard a rumor about that going on in Kaiser in the past.
And that hurts the patients.
That definitely hurts the patients. And it's just not safe. You can't give the genuine care you want to give. And they need to do something about this staffing shortage. And most importantly, our wages. We're living in California. We're living in San Francisco. We need higher wages. We need our bonuses. Kaiser's made money, made $4 billion in the past 5 years. And you mean to tell me you don't have money? That's bull crap. That's crap. And I had to fight for our department so we could stay and try to get rid of us. Part-time people and wanted 8-hour shifts. We fought. Thank God our union and the reps were behind us, and we won, thankfully, and we fought. And again, I'm proud to say I love what I do, and I'm going to continue doing what I do.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome, sir. Thank you.
So my name is Raul Sanchez. I'm a supply chain technician here at Kaiser San Francisco.
And how long have you worked here?
I've worked here for 8 years.
And they say they're short staffing. What does that mean to you as a worker here at Kaiser?
So here, short staffing, especially in my department, meaning that we have had employees that have retired and have left, and they have not replaced those positions, and which makes it a big deal with us because we're less people now having to support the entire hospital, bringing supplies for our patients, which delays patient care. It's a big issue going on in our department, especially dealing during the pandemic and us having a lot of supplies that are on back order. We used to have 4 or 5 clerks before, for instance, that would find the outside orders for we could get to our patients. Now there's only 2 of us doing the work of 4 or 5 people.
Before. That sounds like a very dangerous situation.
It is definitely dangerous, especially when we're bringing supplies for our patients for the operating rooms, which I do support the operating rooms on getting implants, getting stuff. So if we're now only having 2 people trying to find them supplies, it is a big issue and a big deal. It puts our patients at risk.
And how long has this been going on?
This has been going on actually for about 3 years now. So, you know, during the pandemic, we had a lot of employees that, you know, over the times retired and they just haven't backfilled. They've given us basically saying they don't have the budget to backfill these positions, but yet the hospitals are still going. We have a lot of patients coming in.
You have more, even new patients.
We have a lot more new patients coming in, new membership coming in with less workers. So, I mean, go figure. How do we get the you know, they're saying it's a nonprofit organization, but yet our operating rooms, we're doing double the work now with half of the staff.
And that threatens patient care?
Absolutely. We've actually, over the past year or so, been having a fluctuation of having to cut down some of the surgeries or even cancel surgeries due to short staffing, which, you know, now it delays the patient. Patients coming in for a crucial, you know, surgery, and it now delays the process because we have to reschedule them to come back because we don't have enough staffing.
And, you know, also the question of oversight. Who's doing oversight of this hospital? It seems like it's screwed up here.
Yes, it is very, the oversight of this hospital leadership is just, it's horrible right now. We get excuse after excuse. We know, you know, definitely our membership has grown. Our hospitals are still getting filled up even more over the pandemic. We have, you know, still dealing with all these issues. And, you know, at the end of the day, we're patients too, right? We're bringing in our family members. To bring them into a situation like that, I mean, it's unsafe for them.
And what about the government? Aren't they supposed to regulate these hospitals?
Well, I mean, our government that comes in, they regulate what? Every 2 years. And at the time they come in, what do? We're running around hiding stuff. We're putting stuff in hallways. We're sending stuff to warehouses where we can hide the stuff. Our hallways are very packed. We're supposed to have a limited amount of, you know, we have a limited amount of space here as it is. But, you know, with all the surgeries and all the stuff they're coming into, we only regulate when they come in for the 2 weeks, and after that goes back to normal.
Well, it seems like there've been one strike after another here. The engineers,
which was one of the big ones too, and actually we came out in support of them, and they still don't have a contract to this date. That's been over, I believe, a year and a half now. So, you know, a lot of our engineers are now coming out to support us. It's one after another.
And they did offer apparently the nurses a 22% increase.
Yes, I mean, the nurses were on the verge of striking, but they apparently got it right the day before they were going to go out on strike. So 22% is what the nurses got. Cost of living. I'm born and raised here in San Francisco. The inflation has raised up, what, more than 11% for us to live here and off of these wages. We're down at the bottom of everything, but yet doing double the work, being mandated to do overtime to take care of our patients. It's, and you know, because we care for our patients, that's the reason why we're staying doing these double shifts. But you know, it burns us out and it becomes unsafe working conditions.
And you think that the hospital system should be under public control? It seems like they say they're nonprofits, but they're making billions. The executive made apparently $16 million. I mean, it seems like basically screw the worker. We're going to make a lot of money off you.
Yeah, I mean, definitely it is for profit. We do know that. Everybody knows that. All the CEOs, everybody's making these billions of dollars. And us, the frontline workers who are caring for our patients, what do we get? Half, you know, staffing. It's terrible.
And you say that the engineers are without a contract here. Is that union busting?
Yes, it's definitely union busting. We are now, like I said, over a year and a half. The engineers were out here for 3 months with no pay. We came out here and supported. They had to come back to provide for their families and to help us out in our facilities. During that time, our facilities were a wreck. We had busted pipes everywhere. I mean, how was that safe for anything?
And where was OSHA? Where was the state of California doing protecting the hospital and the patient?
Nowhere to be found. Nowhere to be found. Everything that states say, we need more better regulations. We need to bring somebody in here to actually see what's going on here.
Does OSHA ever come by here and really investigate?
I have never seen OSHA down here. Speaking with the engineers, when they come, it is a planned visit. Of course, at that time, everything's up to par.
So you think it's a captured agency? OSHA is really just doing the bidding of the hospital?
Yeah, they're in cahoots with it. I mean, basically, what else can it be? We have stuff broken around here all the time. It's unsafe at times. We've had stuff busting our sterile processing water all over the place, contaminating equipment that we use on our patients. And nobody's coming in here to regulate anything.
And you think these executives should be prosecuted for this? I mean, they promise that they're going to provide health care. They're canceling patients. I mean, mental health care patients commit suicide because they can't get care. It seems like a very much out of control situation.
It's very much out of control. We see our members here all the time. I mean, mental health, you can't even get an appointment. Any type of care that you need in the surgery, you might have to wait 2 to 3 months to get it. Just because, and absolutely, they need to be held accountable for what's going on.
But people pay these fees every month.
And the fees go up more and more, and we have more and more members coming in. So, I mean, something needs to be done with this. There needs to be some type of control. Somebody needs to get involved because it's just out of control.
Those were Kaiser workers protesting low wages and short staffing outside San Francisco's Kaiser Hospital.
get back. I'm all right, Jack. Keep your hands off of my stack. Money, it's a hit. Don't get me back to good, good bullshit. I'm in the high fidelity, first class traveling section. I think I need a lift jet.
That was Pink Floyd, Money. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. Hunter Biden's legal woes keep worsening. Last week, a judge concluded that his plea deal was overly broad, wrongly protecting him from further prosecution, and he then proceeded to plead not guilty. Meanwhile, Glenn Greenwald, on his System Update webcast, said that corruption has never been an issue in Hunter Biden's case, because he's not an elected official. The corruption issue, he said, is Joe Biden's. Here's Glenn Greenwald.
You have this mountain of evidence of Joe Biden's involvement in all of these deals, something the White House has emphatically denied. And now you have the emergence of what I think is arguably the most convincing evidence yet, first reported by the New York Post on July 23rd, which says Hunter Biden put then Vice President Dad Joe on the phone with business associates at least 24 times. Hunter Biden's ex-partner, Devin Archer, is going to testify. So Devin Archer is a longtime business partner and associate of Hunter Biden, just like Tony Bobulinski was. And he's evidently reportedly prepared to testify that on at least 24 occasions, Hunter Biden put his father, Joe Biden, on the calls with his associates, including when Joe Biden was vice president, to demonstrate what was clearly the case, that Joe Biden was trying to demonstrate that Hunter Biden really had value because he could and would get Joe Biden to take action to benefit these companies that were paying Hunter Biden. Quote, Hunter Biden would dial in his father, then Vice President Joe Biden, on speakerphone into meetings with his overseas business partners, according to testimony expected before Congress this week from Devin Archer, the first son's former best friend. Archer, 48, who is facing jail for his role in a $60 million bond fraud, is scheduled to testify to the House Oversight Committee about meetings he witnessed that were attended by Joe Biden, either in person or via speakerphone, when Hunter would call his father and introduce him to foreign business partners or prospective investors. One such meeting was in Dubai late in the evening of Friday, December 4th, 2015, when a board meeting of the Ukrainian energy company Burisma, which was paying Hunter $83,000 a month as director. When they were sitting outside at the bar, originally that figure was $50,000. It's been discovered that in fact, it was significantly higher. He was getting paid $83,000 a month. $83,000 a month. A full-time job, basically $1 million a year. Despite knowing nothing about the energy industry and specifically Ukrainian energy, obviously because there was value being provided by Hunter Biden, which could only have come in the form of access to his father. And yet the media has been insisting for years that you're supposed to believe that at no point did Joe Biden ever speak to Hunter about any of this, even in the face of all of this evidence, which they've been lying about for years. The article goes on, quote, while they were sitting outside at the bar, Vadim Pozorovsky, a senior Burisma executive, phoned to ask where they were because Burisma's owner, Mikhail Zhevchevsky, needed to speak to Hunter urgently. Hunter Biden's former business partner, Devin Archer, is expected to testify to Congress this week about how Hunter Biden would call then Vice President Joe Biden during meetings with foreign business associates. Soon afterwards, the two Ukrainians joined Hunter and Archer at the Four Seasons Bar, and Pozorovsky asked Hunter, quote, can you ring your dad? At the time, it was early afternoon Friday in Washington, D.C. Hunter then called his father, put him on speakerphone, placed the phone on the table, and introduced the Ukrainians to Joe Biden by name as Nikolai and Vadim. He also said words to the effect that the Burisma bigwigs, quote, need our support. Vice President Biden greeted the Ukrainians, but spoke only in vague pleasantries during the short call and in other such interactions with Hunter's overseas business partners. Archer is expected to testify. Congressional investigators are expected to probe the reasons for Zelensky's requesting the urgent phone call with Joe Biden. 3 days after the speaker phone call, the then vice president, who was the point man for the Obama administration for Ukraine, was due to fly to Kiev to address the Ukrainian parliament, known as the Rada, on December 9, 2015, about, quote, the poison of cronyism, corruptionism, and kleptocracy. He was going to lecture the Ukrainians, Joe Biden was, on the poison of cronyism, corruption, and kleptocracy. 10 weeks before that call, on September 24th, 2015, U.S. Ambassador Gregory Pyatt had given a speech about corruption in Odessa, in which he targeted Zelensky by name. By then, Ukrainian Prosecutor General Viktor Shokin was investigating Burisma for corruption, and within 2 months, on February 2nd, 2016, would seize 4 houses in Kyiv, 2 plots of land, and a Rolls Royce belonging to Zelensky, who was living in exile in Dubai. A month later, Shokin was fired after Joe Biden threatened to withhold $1 billion in U.S. aid to Ukraine, which basically is what Donald Trump was impeached for also doing, threatening to withhold aid to Ukraine unless the Ukrainians cooperated in the investigation to determine whether or not Joe Biden was engaged in corruption in Ukraine by helping Hunter and the people paying Hunter. Quote, Hunter performed the same party trick as many as 24 times in Archer's presence. The Long Island business-born father of three is expected to tell congressional investigators under oath. Another former business partner, Tony Bobulinski, recalls Hunter offering to get his father on the phone during a meeting by the pool at the Chateau Marmont in L.A. Quote, I am also aware of other Biden family business associates confirming that Joe would take phone calls from Hunter in the middle of business meetings and would weigh in via speakerphone, said Bobulinski. Now, Joe Biden, before all of this emerged, publicly boasted about the role that he played in getting this Ukrainian prosecutor fired. The reason that Burisma decided that they needed to pay the son of a politician to help them with their legal problems and chose not a son of a Ukrainian politician, but the son of an American politician, was because ever since that 2014 coup engineered by Victoria Nuland in Ukraine, Joe Biden was basically running Ukraine, micromanaging it to the point of picking and choosing which prosecutors they could appoint and had to fire. Imagine some other country involved in American governance on that level of demanding that certain prosecutors be fired. That's the extent to which Joe Biden had his fingers in the governance of Ukraine, which is why it made sense for a Ukrainian energy company to pay Hunter Biden close to $1 million a year just to sit on his board, because the only value that he had was access to the person running Ukraine. And Joe Biden openly boasted about how he blackmailed the Ukrainians into firing this prosecutor. Here he is in 2018 talking about the role that Joe Biden played in getting this Ukrainian prosecutor fired.
I'll give you one concrete example. I was, but it just happened to be that was the assignment I got. I got all the good ones. So I got Ukraine. I remember going over convincing our team, our others, to convincing us that we should be providing for loan guarantees. And I went over, I guess, the 12th, 13th time to Kyiv, and I was supposed to announce that there was another $1 billion loan guarantee. And I had gotten a commitment from Poroshenko and from Yatsenyuk that they would take action against the state prosecutor, and they didn't. So they said they were walking out to press conference. I said, we're not going to give you the $1 billion. They said, you have no authority. You're not the president. The president said. I said, call him. I said, I'm telling you, you're not getting $1 billion. I said, you're not getting the billion. I'm going to be leaving here. And I think it was, 6 hours? I said, I'm leaving in 6 hours. If the prosecutor's not fired, you're not getting the money. Oh, son of a bitch. Got fired. And they put in place someone who was solid at the time.
This is somebody who was elected by the American people to be an American political official. Go back and look at that 2012 campaign where Barack Obama ran with Joe Biden for re-election against Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan. And they talked about all the things they were going to do for the American working class, for American companies, for the unemployed. And then they get into office, and Joe Biden, look at how much time he's spending micromanaging Ukraine. He said in this video, just kind of in passing, this is the 12th or 13th time I went to Kiev. Why is the United States so obsessed with and fixated on the internal governance of Ukraine? It didn't just start once Russia invaded in 2022. The United States has been governing Ukraine on such a granular level that you see Joe Biden laughing about the fact that he forced them to fire a prosecutor they didn't want to fire, that he wanted fired, that again helped the company paying his son close to $1 million a year, even though Joe Biden and his media allies claim he was just carrying out EU policy that wanted this prosecutor gone because he wasn't doing enough to fight corruption. But this is exactly the sort of thing that Joe Biden and his family have been doing forever. And they're making enormous amounts of money by doing it. And there's a mountain of evidence that Joe Biden has been heavily involved in every step of these transactions. The idea that Hunter Biden has been going around the world invoking his father's name in all these very explicit and aggressive ways, and his father never got wind of it, had no idea that it happened, is laughable.
That was Glenn Greenwald on Hunter Biden's legal struggles and their implications for his father, President Joe Biden. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org, and make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.